morning, Timmy. Good morning, Easton. Okay, so a lot of interesting rashis in Parshas Bo. Just open to the Korban Pesach section. I just figured we'd talk a little bit about the Korban Pesach section. So we've seen a lot of Sefer Brachos where you've got foreign words being used in the Torah. And very often Rashi will help us interpret what that foreign word means. So Mea Kesita, when Yaakov purchases the land near Shechem, Rashi says that Kesita is a foreign word. Probably the most famous foreign word is this week's Parsha, Totafos. So how does Totafos refer to Tefillin? So Rabbi Akiva famously said that in Africa, in those days, Tat was two and Pat was two. That was the way they would refer to numbers. So Tatfat or Totafot is four, and Tefillin is four Parshas. But the question is always, why does the Torah choose this moment to introduce a foreign word? What's the hidden message? I mean, the Torah has plenty of words in Hebrew. Why does the Torah import a foreign word? What if they've used a local or domestic word? So here's one such example. The Torah is carefully regulated the way the Korban Pesach is eaten. And the Korban Pesach can't be cooked. It has to be roasted. It has to be roasted as an entire animal. It can't be cut into scraps. Rosho al krav v'al kirbo. And it can't be in raw, under roasted. It has to be fully roasted. Those are the three basic parameters that govern the cooking process. There's also parameters governing the eating process, when you eat, how you eat. So first of all, before I even get to Rashi, let me talk about it through the lens of Rashi. Maybe the prism of Rashi will make this point even more obvious. So al tochlu menu na. Now na in Hebrew means please. Hine na. Al na. Kel na. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't eat with saying please. Of course you should have good table manners. So here the word na means al tochlu menu na. Rashi says na means raw or under roasted. Okay. News to us. We don't have any psukim in the Torah in which the word na means under roasted. So Rashi says, Kar'u na b'lashon Arabi. In Arabic, the word na means under roasted. So why is the Torah using an Arabic word here? So part of the answer is number one, that the Torah at a very early stage of our identity is creating identity around food. And this will be something that will be even more regulated when the Torah is given, and Jews have a very, very strict diet. It's called kosher. It's called meat and milk. And to a degree, food is very formative and very transformative. And you can appreciate, even in today's modern world, how food has kept Jewish identity very powerfully embedded, even in people for whom religion and ritual and Torah study is less compelling. There's an entire industry called Jewish food and Jewish cooking and Jewish culinary. So by telling us, eat it in a Jewish way, don't eat it in a non-Jewish way, and using a word to describe the way you shouldn't eat this meal, but a foreign word, the Torah is reminding us that we're starting to build national identity. Obviously, national identity will be built along the really important and surpassing issues, Torah, Hashem, Eretz Yisrael, mitzvos. But there's going to be a way to build that. What makes Judaism so powerful is that it has many, many layers to it. And even when identity isn't fastened on ritual and Torah, it's fastened, Baruch Hashem, on food and become a very powerful force, especially during the periods of history in which other aspects have been obscured or been diminished. But as well, there's an attempt in Mitzrayim to transform them from a slave mentality to a kingdom of priests, or a kingdom of princes, for two reasons. First of all, because they have to stand at Har Sinai, and they have to accept Hashem and buy into monotheism. Monotheism is not a simple religion. It's a baffling religion. You can't see Hashem, you can't describe Hashem. You need to be a strong person, a confident person, an imaginative person. Slaves have very little imagination. They don't have time to imagine. They don't have time to think abstractly. They're always thinking for survival mode. We saw this in Parshas Ve'era. They're working so hard, couldn't imagine long-term vision, broad horizons. So they've got to break the slave mentality. Now, slaves obviously eat in a very, very hurriedly and ignoble fashion. So that night, they're going to be eating in a very elegant fashion. All three of these mitzvos All three of these parameters are all meant to show them and to help them become elegant, aristocrats, proud, confident. So for example, if you don't have a lot of food, you have to cook it, because you add water and juice and you make a stew or chalent to make a chalent or a goulash, because you want to make a soup. Or but if you're very, very wealthy, my kids have an expression, fancy but not filling, because these fancy restaurants, small little piece, you're really hungry. The assumption is people who eat in fancy restaurants are eating multiple meals a day. That meal doesn't have to be like a gas station or refilling. That's just a meal where it's like a snack. You're trying to taste the food, how well it tastes. So if you're very poor, you have to cook. You have to introduce fruits, vegetables, spices, water. You got to create something soupy, goulashy. So the fact that they couldn't cook it meant to them say, you shouldn't. One of the hardest things for people that have been through traumatic food experiences is to recover. Your grandparents probably didn't throw out any of their food, because they probably were involved in the Holocaust in some way. They went through the Holocaust, or the first generation after the Holocaust. And the starvation in the Holocaust was so severe for those that survived, even in the ghettos, that they were traumatized by food. They couldn't throw away food. It was very, very difficult for my grandparents to throw away even crumbs and morsels of food, because it's very visceral. It's very deep in your identity. And to go through a period of starvation, and then so HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to help them transform specifically through food. Not to be hoarders, not to gorge on food, not to worry about the next meal, not to feel that they have to. In classic, again, we're far removed, because we go to a butcher, or we go to the supermarket, we buy our meats prepackaged and pre-cut. But typically, up until about 100 years ago, you'd go to the butcher, and the first person online was the nobleman or the aristocrat. And what would he do? He'd take the front quarter of the animal and the back quarter of the animal. Those were the juiciest and tastiest parts. And then they'd cut the animal into small little parts, all these ugly, disgusting pieces, the lips, the ears, the head, the bony, the ribs, very little meat, very fatty. And they'd cut these scraps up, and the poor people would take on these little scraps. So no one really had a full animal. Even the rich people didn't have a full animal. They needed it. They could afford not to have one. So the fact that the Jews are taking an entire animal and roasting it in one unit, that's very novel. They've probably never seen that in their lives. At best, whatever meat they had was a scrap here, or an eyeball there, or a lung here, a liver there. They're scraps. They never got the real. So they take the entire animal. So this is part of it, not to eat things that are undercooked, not to eat things in a hurry, not to feel, again, also when you cook, when you roast meat too extensively, it can shrink and shrivel. So there's a poor man would have a vested interest in not over-roasting the meat, because that would make the meat contract. So all these are an attempt to build not just symbolic ways of eating because of all sorts of other symbolisms or messages. It's an attempt to build Jewish identity, that you are princes, you are kings, you're not nomads, you're not those Arabs which in those days, these nomads roaming the land who had to eat quickly because they had to move to the next mountain because they were on the run because they were involved in a war. You eat at peace, you eat elegantly, you eat like a nobleman, you eat without fear of tomorrow's bread. So in order to highlight this, the Torah says, don't eat like those Arabs. Don't eat, no. He uses a foreign word to say this isn't just a mitzvah like shatnez, or a mitzvah like, I don't know, this is a demarcating mitzvah, which will create Jewish identity for generations, and will be expanded into the laws of kosher. This is just very, very, this is like the training session. That you, when you eat, you have to eat under regulatory fields as well. But also, you're creating an identity as a king, not a nomad, not someone who wanders. You're princes. You're Hashem's children. To reflect it. It's very important at your age, again, not to take it too extreme, but to be careful how you eat at the table, that proper table matters, to eat in a dignified fashion. When you eat is one of the times in life that you're closest to being an animal, and you want to protect your humanity specifically at that point. Okay? That's one Rashi. Another Rashi is Bechipazon. So we interpret Bechipazon. You should eat it hurriedly. Bechipazon Pesach Hu Lashem. However, Rashi says you should have just eaten it hurriedly. Rashi interprets Bechipazon two words. Lashon Behala U'mihirus. Hurriedly, quickly, mihirut, but Behala. And Rashi quotes certain psukim that highlight the fact that Chipazon means hurry, panic, mayhem, chaos. So that night, they had to eat the Karban Pesach in a state of chaos. Not just quickly, not just to eat the food quickly, but to do it in a way that's almost disorderly, because the night was the night of Chipazon, Ki b'Chipazon yatzatzim Mitzrayim. Now, why is it hurried, not just quick? Well, the truth is, Chipazon characterize the experience of the Egyptians and also characterize the experience of the Jewish people. The Gemara in Brachos on Daf Tes says that the Torah says the word chipazon yathasim yisrayim twice, once in Bo, once in Re'eh. One refers to the way the Jewish people left, one refers to the way the Mitzrayim experienced the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So the chipazon doesn't just qualify the Egyptian experience, it also qualifies the Jewish experience. So for the Egyptians to not just be hurried, but to be chaotic and disorderly and dysfunctional, Hashem is breaking their ego, breaking their will, breaking their sense of control. It's not just happening quickly, but you had a loss of words, you're panicked, you're running in different directions, you're wandering, you're screaming. So for the Egyptians, this was a psychological dismantling of ego and of pride. But for the Jewish people, why is it important that they be chaotic and disorderly? It's important that they be quick, because quick conveys a sense of urgency. This has to happen now, Hashem wants this to happen, and there's a sense of divine intervention. But why are the Jewish people experiencing chaos and mayhem tonight? And why are they eating? Why is Hashem prophesizing they can eat the Karban Pesach b'chipazon, not just mehiras, but behala? So part of it is the romance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is not just the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, but this is the night where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is taking us as his bride. This is the night we reach her Hashirim. This is the night where Hashem is swooping down into history and taking us as his chosen. And the chaos conveys a sense of relinquishing control. Sometimes in a relationship, in romance, it feels good to relinquish control to the other. That's why the Baal of Avodah Zarah was so popular in the days of Sefer Shoftim, because it allowed men to become women. Men carry responsibility in ancient biblical worlds. They're the ones who are the breadwinners. They're the ones who have to defend the family. They carry heavy responsibility. There's something cathartic about letting go and letting yourself be carried by someone else. So this pagan culture allowed men to be women, to see God as their Baal, and they could be the wise, and they could say, God, just take over. You take control. I don't have anything to worry about. You're the Baal. I'm the Isha. In ancient patriarchal society, where there's clear demarcation between men and women. So the sense of letting go is what Hashem wants in order to create that romance. That you're not just that it's happening quickly, but you don't know whether you're coming or going, and you just rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's a great way to prepare for the desert, where there's no way you can control or predict what will happen in the desert. You just have to let go and trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kol Amar Hashem, Zecharti Lech Hasdin Yerayach, Avas Kulosayach, Lechtech Acharai, Bamidbar Be'eretz Lozor. The entire entering into the desert is Lechtech Acharai, just two. And that's an important modality, even in your personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Hasidus talked a lot about this ability just to let go and let HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes you keep butting up against a problem and you can't solve the problem and you're not getting anywhere. At some point in Hasidus, it's called Hispatlos. You just have to let yourself go and say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whatever you decide for me is fine. I know I want this endpoint. I'm trying to reach this conclusion, trying to reach this decision. I just, evidently, I can't. You decide for me, and I'll just accept your fate, and I'll just accept what you have in store for me. It's an important part of life. As you grow older, you'll realize the moments you have to just be mispatel to Hashem, that you can't just engage and further engage and try to pursue. So for Mitzrayim, the behala of chipazon, not just the immediacy and the rapidity, but the behala of chipazon is meant to convey lack of ego, lack of control, because Hashem had to break their egotism and egomaniacal positions. For the Jewish people, it's more romance with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we just let Hashem, you take us, and we don't even have control of our order and organization. It's not just the timing. So this is an interesting Rashi. The second Rashi is chipazon, means mehirot ubehala. The third Rashi, very quickly, is v'yahadam lochem li'os al abatim. It's because a lot of people don't know, the blood was sprinkled not outside on the doorpost, but inside on the doorpost. So if you walk by in the same, you do not see blood on the doorpost. V'haya lahadam lachem li'os. Rashi says, lachem li'os v'lo lacherem li'os mekan shalo nosnu hadam elam mibifnim. They only put the blood on the inner part of the doorpost. So very quickly, number one, it shows the importance of signs and icons, even for yourself. Signs aren't just meant to show other people who you are, but they're meant to be important reinforcers of identity. So no one saw the blood. The Jewish people saw the blood. They're not trying to broadcast or exhibit it to others. They're just trying to create a bris with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Second of all, even though this is the night of bris, and even though the night of bris is pivoted around blood, the notion of putting blood on your doorpost is very pagan. To put blood and to show people blood. We're not a nation that celebrates black magic and blood. And so that night there's a need for blood. But there are a lot of religions that are, and as you know, Christianity and other religions that are very deeply surrounding the imageries of blood. And although there is blood in Judaism, and it's so essential to Korbanos, at least in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, and it's central that night to the blood of Korban Milah, of Korban Pesach and Milah, it's not something that we ostentatiously exhibit. The blood is kept in a very pure. We saw in the Bris Milah Kadosh Baruch Hu that a Bris Milah, we don't hold up the blood. There is blood involved, but in a very, very curtailed and monitored fashion, not in a way that can get out of hand and become very graphic and very paganistic or very blood celebrated or death celebrated. And it's a very important Judaism's relationship with blood, and the tone is set here. There is an aspect of blood that's very iconic, but it's very private rather than being exhibited on the doorpost. So it's an important shift that not many people are aware of. The blood was not visible to the bypassers, it was just visible to the family. Okay, So three Rashis. Rashi number one, the description of raw or under roasted meat in a foreign word. Number two, chipazon, not just quickly, but also in a way that created panic, mayhem, lack of control. And finally, v'haya hadam lachem leos, Rashi says lachem leos, v'lo lachem leos.